Stretching across Asia, from northern Manchuria through Tibet, west through Persia, and ending in Kurdistan, was a chain of 7 towers on isolated mountaintops. And in each of these towers sat continually a priest of Satan, who, by broadcasting occult vibrations, controlled the destinies of the world for evil. From Adventures in Arabia by William Seabrook, 1928. According to John Keel, author of the famed Mothman Prophecies, a metaphorical 8th tower was installed by non-human entities, and its effects can still be felt to this day. It influences all aspects of the paranormal through manipulation of a theoretical energy field that Keel calls the superspectrum. The manifestations of this energy field varies from lights in the sky to physical entities lurking in shadowy recesses. Throughout human history, esoteric cabals, Stygian priests, and power-hungry god-kings have manipulated the superspectrum in their favor. In the modern day, the superspectrum influences psychic abilities, vanishings, and cryptid sightings. But the 8th tower, the generator of the energy used by the superspectrum, is dying. I'm your host, Jason, and you're listening to the Esoteric Book Club. Welcome back, goblins! By now, most people are aware of the Mothman. Many people recognize that John Keel was the man who was responsible for investigating the events, all of which culminated in the book The Mothman Prophecies. While the collapse of the Silver Bridge marked the end of a majority of the sightings in Point Pleasant, it was instead a turning point for Keel. When The Mothman Prophecies was written, it was meant to be a much longer and far more esoteric book. So much so that the publisher asked Keel to remove a lot of conjecture about the wider spectrum of the paranormal and how it interacts with humanity. While The Mothman Prophecies went on to be a cult classic, spawning a major motion picture, Keel still felt the need to expand on his theories. Thus, the 8th Tower was born. Also known as A Cosmic Question in Overseas Markets, this work looks at the paranormal as a whole, rather than as isolated events. You see, to Keel, there may be little difference between Little Green Men and Bigfoot. Because this book is now 46 years old, I had to read it, and will be presenting it, in a slightly different way. I read his words in the context of his era and looked at how modern science and modern paranormal investigation have either confirmed or debunked his conclusions. Keel made several predictions in the 8th Tower, and while many of them have not come to pass, we can see how his thinking shaped the direction of paranormal research. We begin roughly 2,000 years ago with a routine execution in a remote Roman province. 2 Roman soldiers are arguing over a robe taken from one of the executed criminals. One guard wants to cut it up for rags, but the other insists that they can't do that. It's a really nice robe, and it would be a shame to cut it up. Eventually, they agree to draw lots to see who gets to keep the robe. It concludes when one guard asks, "Hey, what was that guy's name anyway?" The other guard replies, "Yahashua?" "Doesn't mean a thing to me. There's thousands of Yahashuas around here." As you can probably guess, that Yahashua, eventually translated into Joshua, was really Jesus Christ. Keel is obviously trying to be provocative, which today, this seems pretty mundane, but in the 1960s, this scene would have raised a few eyebrows. Ultimately, This was a lead-in to his premise that people have been having revelatory visitations throughout human history. Some lead to religious zeal, while some lead to the asylum, and really every stage in between the two. The death and resurrection of Christ is not a wholly unique story. Thousands of years earlier, the Egyptians told of the dismemberment and resurrection of Osiris. The life-death-rebirth cycle is a common occurrence in many world religions. The reborn gods aren't just relegated to the past, either. Keel himself recalls that in his time in India, there were tales of the gods walking the earth in the modern day. To quote Keel, "The central problem is not the questionable reality of these images of Vishnu, Osiris, and Christ. It is the human and/or cosmic system that produces the entities and the beliefs that they motivate." End quote. Since the writing of this book, the world has seen an increase in cults and beliefs based on otherworldly entities. Jim Jones convinced his followers that they would go on to another planet upon their deaths. Heaven's Gate attendees felt that their souls would ascend to an alien spacecraft when they passed. Now, we have Scientology, which believes in although it's probably best that I don't go into that. I understand that they're a bit lawsuit happy. The point is that the ecstatic visions of the past are not too dissimilar to the rise of modern cults after their leaders receive extraterrestrial information downloads. What Keel is asking is, where does this information come from? This is ultimately the premise of his entire book. To answer the question, Keel proposes a theory. Around us, at all times, is an energy force, one beyond the visible light spectrum. He refers to this as the superspectrum. Don't worry, there aren't any midichlorians involved, although Keel's superspectrum does sound a lot like the Force. Keel further details that the superspectrum lies outside the electromagnetic spectrum. It is also beyond, but sometimes overlapping, the visible light spectrum, which is a small subsection of the electromagnetic spectrum. He explains that this is how some people can see paranormal events, while others cannot. It's sort of like being colorblind, but in this instance, you may see the big hairy monster, and the guy beside you doesn't. This also explains why UFOs seem to shift through various colors between the time that they appear and between when they vanish. According to Keel, it's because they are shifting from one end of the superspectrum through the visible light spectrum and then back to the lower end of the superspectrum. Are you still with me? Yeah, I thought it was a bit much when I first read it too. But Keel anticipated this reaction. To better explain this, he jumps back to the turn of the century. The very fact that you are able to listen to this podcast at your leisure is essentially because of one man, Guglielmo Marconi. Okay, so that may be a bit reductive, but Marconi is generally considered to be the father of radio, and without radio broadcasting, there wouldn't have been the evolution into podcasting. Marconi was experimenting with the electromagnetic spectrum, notably the manipulation of the waves produced by it. Visible light is just one small part of the EM spectrum, but Marconi was testing the extremes. He started out experimenting with short waves, but all he managed to do was accidentally create a death ray that murdered his neighbor's livestock. This would have been achieved through the use of waves lower than visible light, infrared, and even lower than ultraviolet. We're talking gamma levels of radiation, so we're probably lucky that we didn't end up with rampaging, hulked-out sheep. This is about the time that he drew the attention of Benito Mussolini. Mussolini wanted what any fascist dictator wants: weapons. Marconi, he was trying to avoid that field of research, so he began researching VLF waves, short for very low frequency. VLF waves are long waves as opposed to short waves of his accidental death ray. What Marconi discovered is best relayed in a story. In June of 1936, Benito Mussolini's wife, Rachel, left on a trip to Ostia. Before she left, her husband winked and said, "I wouldn't be surprised if you had a very unusual experience today." He wouldn't really expand on his cryptic statement, so Rachel got into her limousine and left on her trip. Along the way, there was a stretch of road where all vehicles were pulled over on the curb. The drivers had their hoods open, inspecting their engines. Rachel asked the limo driver what was going on as they approached, but before he could answer, their own engine sputtered and stalled. After a few moments of confusion, everyone's engine started again and people continued on their way. What happened is that Marconi had stumbled onto a very specific wavelength that created a VLF pulse that short-circuited electronic devices. All gas combustion engines rely on electrical charges, so they stalled when they got within range of his device. Oddly enough, older diesel engines don't rely on electrical ignition, so they would have been otherwise unaffected. Today, we know this pulse frequency as EMP, or electromagnetic pulse. As fascinating as Marconi's research is, what is the point of it in relation to the superspectrum? His work demonstrates the full gamut of ways that a single wavelength can function and manifest. At one end, we have death rays, and at the other, we have long-range radio communication and EMP devices. Keel spends several chapters exploring how just the manipulation of this one wavelength can yield so many varied results. Keep in mind that when this book was written, several physicists had already previously discussed the fifth-dimensional forces, but the theory of what we know today as string theory was just being formed. On a side note, Russian-born French scientist Vladimir Gavreau is the only person to have been awarded a patent for a sonic death ray. His work worked a little too well. Gavreau's death ray worked using infrasound and had an effective range of 5 miles. But it had two problems. First, it couldn't be directed or aimed, so it harmed the users as well as the targets. Second, it killed everything. I'm talking leaves falling from trees, birds plummeting from the sky, grass wilting, everything. Apparently, the patent is not sealed, and anyone can obtain it from the patent office in Paris. Since the release of this book, we now have something known as the Active Denial System, or ADS, a device developed by the U.S. military and prototyped in short-range form by Raytheon. It basically works the same way as Gavreau's death ray, utilizing VLF waves to heat up a target's surface. It's not on the level of microwave, but prolonged exposure can yield second-degree burns. All of this from an invisible subsonic cannon. You may also recall from past episodes the mysterious Havana Syndrome affecting U.S. diplomats. The current theory is that a VLF device is projecting sub-microwave pulses into the person's room. These waves aren't meant to cook the target, but they could cause malaise, fatigue, headache, and paranoia. This just demonstrates that this isn't some archaic technology that was being researched in the middle of last century. EM wave technology is still being developed, and in some places, is in active use today. Electromagnetic waves aren't just a result of human technology, though. In fact, magnetic anomalies are so common that the U.S. Geological Survey researched and mapped them back in the 1950s. It's actually pretty fascinating if you have a chance to look at this map. My town is the center of one of the stronger anomalies in this country, so yay? While this survey may be the first of the atomic age, it's not the first time that a culture has recorded the flow of geomagnetic currents. In China, there is the concept of dragon lines, or currents of earth energy. In the Americas, there is speculation that the mound builder culture used these same lines to plot the location of their constructions. In the mid-1800s, this was described in broad terms as telluric currents. These currents differ from geomagnetic currents in that they encompass both natural and man-made waves that pass through the earth and sea. That last part is key, because it shows that these waves, by virtue of being detectable through great depths of water, are in the VLF range. At this stage, we can start to see the growth of Keel's premise on the superspectrum. It's a form of energy. Its use and application can be as varied as the electromagnetic spectrum, part of which seems to overlap. This field is then something that humanity can tap into, tune into, and manipulate. If this is the case, what would that look like? It's clear from generations of paranormal research that it's not something that can be detected with technology, except in the instances where it overlaps with the EM spectrum. Keel proposes that the use and manipulation of the superspectrum would look like, well, magic. In more modern manifestations, this would be psychic abilities. It seems like a bit of a stretch, but let's look at the details. The superspectrum, as with most energy types, would exist as a wave. Based on the length of the wave, different effects take place. Like a tuned-in radio, certain frequencies can be used to send or receive messages. The communication device in this instance is the human mind. Some people are born tuned in to a specific wavelength, while others spend years of practice and meditation learning to adjust the dial, if you will. To continue with the radio analogy, think about channel frequencies. A station will broadcast at a specific frequency measured in hertz. To hear the broadcast, you have to set your radio dial to the same value. In terms of telepathy, if you want to read a person's mind, you would have to be able to tune your innate psychic dial until you find the frequency that your target is broadcasting on. That same principle would be used if you wanted to send a message as well. Furthermore, Keel proposes that time is relative compared to how we perceive it. Sometimes our psychic radio receiver stumbles upon a frequency that allows a person to see past events or even future possibilities. Even more fascinating is that when this book was being written, the U.S. government was actively working on a psychic remote viewing project. This project was under the auspices of the Defense Intelligence Agency and began in 1972. The copyright date for the first printing of The Eighth Tower is 1975, although Keel was beginning to formulate his ideas while investigating and reporting on the Mothman sightings in the late 1960s. This could just be an instance of cultural zeitgeist causing the two unrelated search topics to overlap, but if you follow the direction of Keel's theories, he would say that it is all an example of the superspectrum in motion. Now that we have a loose idea of what the superspectrum is, we need to look at where it comes from. It almost seems like Keel provides two answers. One that is implied through the text, but also one that he unfolds in chapter 19. By the end, they overlap, but they also form a chicken-or-the-egg type paradox. Throughout the book, Keel implies that in the distant past, primitive man lived alongside the other. Were they gods? Aliens? More advanced humans? It's really hard to say. At times, it seems like Keel is leaning in one direction, but he later presents another scenario. I think the vagaries may be intentional. No matter the real face of the other, Keel works from the premise that they knew what the superspectrum was and how to manipulate it. He is also unclear as to whether the other installed an artificial generator for the superspectrum, or whether it was generated by the Earth itself. Either way, the other is no longer around, and the energy they once put to use is now flowing free. In the history of mankind, there were people who could use the superspectrum. They took leadership roles, becoming priests and god-kings. With each successive generation, their offspring had less and less ability to tap into this energy source. Keel theorizes that this is the real reason behind the royal tendency towards inbreeding. The families weren't just trying to preserve a bloodline, they were attempting to preserve the genetic ability to use the superspectrum. Modern man has very little ability to tap into this energy source, and it only seems to manifest intermittently as psychic abilities or through coincidence. Beyond human ability, there also seems to be spontaneous manifestations which take shape depending on the collective consciousness of the people at the time. If someone expects to see a Bigfoot, it will manifest as a big hairy monster. If they expect aliens, they're gonna see a UFO. There is also an underlying idea that the Earth itself, as a biological entity, may be creating things with the superspectrum, utilizing it as a sort of immune system. Which, yes, that implies that mankind is a virus. Although, I think symbiotic parasite may be a better descriptor. It's at this point that I'm ready to disembark this ride. Keel's ideas are rather fascinating, and I think he may be onto something with the superspectrum. Many paranormal researchers and experiencers today are starting to question whether there isn't something a bit more mythological to their encounters. While the mainstream reports tend to present straightforward stories, there are plenty of oddball tales of Bigfoot chasing a glowing ball of light, or aliens serving pancakes to farmers in exchange for water. Yes, both of these are real examples. So the answers may not be as simple as an undiscovered species of ape hiding in the woods. That doesn't mean we have to bring ancient aliens into the equation to explain their origins. Granted, humans may be an extraterrestrial genetic experiment, so who's to say that they didn't modify the planet a bit while they were here? In the breaks between writing this episode, something occurred to me. Mankind has yet to fully master the electromagnetic spectrum. Hell, we barely understand it. Ghost hunters still utilize EMF detectors to help signify the presence of an undetected energy source, and they listen for electronic voice phenomena on their recording devices. While there are theories as to what causes EMF spikes and EVPs, science has yet to fully explain why they manifest in the first place. Sure, we may have working sonic death rays, but why can't we aim them? We have lasers, which are just light waves on a specific frequency of the visible light spectrum, but we are just learning how to utilize them in ways other than burning and cutting things. The LED, or light-emitting diode, was conceptualized in the very early 1900s, but it wasn't used to generate a wavelength in the visible light spectrum until the 1960s. Interestingly enough, early uses included radio broadcasting and infrared communications. I think the point I'm trying to make is that we may not need the superspectrum to explain why these things are happening when we can barely harness the potential within the EM spectrum. While I think the theories within this book are interesting and that Keel may be onto something with his idea that various paranormal events may not be unrelated, I don't think we necessarily need satanic Kabbalists chanting in mountaintop towers to explain it. Sometimes, the most likely solution is right in front of you. Then again, you may not agree with me. If that's the case, check out The Eighth Tower by John Keel. In fact, I think people should read this anyway, just to get a glimpse at historic paranormal research. Like I said, a lot of his theories are being picked up today, just not in their entirety. His predictions weren't always accurate, but he was surprisingly prescient with them. One thing that impressed me about Keel more than anything else was his interpersonal skills. He kept in touch with witnesses and interviewees. Because of this, he was able to better grasp their ongoing mental state and physical health. He even mentions it in his book that paranormal research doesn't end with witness interviews. He often remained in communication with experiencers until they came to an untimely and sometimes mysterious demise. Lingering health issues would indicate exposure to toxins or, in some cases, various types of irradiation. So while I may not fully embrace his theories, I do respect his methods. As always, I will post a link in the show notes. Esoteric Book Club can be found on Facebook, Patreon, and at esotericbookclub.org. If you like what you hear, I would appreciate it if you would consider making a donation to help pay for research materials, server costs, and a steady supply of coffee. You can join my Patreon page for as little as $1 a month, and rewards are tiered based on your donor level. Higher level donors, such as Samantha Shaver, get a shout out on every single show. Intro and outro music is courtesy of Sarah Rudy and her band Hello June. Their music can be found at bandcamp.com or at wearehellojune.com. The Esoteric Book Club will be at the first annual Cryptid Bash. That's right, I said first annual. I'm throwing that out into the universe, so let's make it happen. It will be held on August 7th in Morgantown, West Virginia. There will be artists, podcasters, authors, researchers, and other various vendors there, so come check it out. Admission is free, so really, you don't have an excuse to not come to this. That's all I have for tonight. So until next time, remember, stay weird.